So I want to thank the Langs also for kindly hosting this this evening, and in general, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to do this because when I did this the first time for the group, it was December 2014. It was the first time I had the chance to really seriously read an Agnon story, and to turn around and have to explain it to people is what made me read it seriously. And I loved it, and then I taught one for a class at Shari Shamayim, a different story, and this is now my third attempt at teaching a story. And each time I learn new things, and it's really it's an eye-opener for me, and it's a lot of fun. The story of Levet Abba that we're doing this evening, to Father's House, I actually picked it for the very simple reason that it was short and it involved Pesach. Those are my criteria for what we were going to do. But the more I read this story, there was kind of a curve, which I think of as my Agnon curve. Whenever I read a story from Sefer Maasim, from the Book of Deeds, the curve is of confusion. And it goes up, 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 up. And then suddenly I'll reach a point where, oh, wait, now I get it. And then it curves downward, and I finally feel like I got it. And it was certainly true with this story, where I'm just reading it, getting more confused, and Isaac Euchel, and the candle in the bottle, and the inn, and what does this have to do with Pesach? And then at one point, it just all clicked, what I hope will emerge in the discussion this evening is a vision of a story which functions really on at least three different levels in terms of the journeys home that people take. I will also note, I would appreciate it if people would interrupt me in the middle. Please do not wait for the end. Ask questions, make comments, throw out ideas. Don't wait for the end, please. My first source on the sheet comes from an interview given by Norman Locke. Norman Locke is a novelist and a playwright. I don't know if he's Jewish, which is interesting when you think about it in terms of what you're about to read from what he said. He sounds like he ought to be, but when you do the classic Google of writer's name and Jewish, nothing comes up. So I don't actually know. But he writes, the quote from him, I should say, in the article goes this way. He was asked about his favorite short story. He says, "Agnon's to Father's House means something to me. Something personal, in the way of a parable, admonishing me for what is everywhere evident in my Love Among the Particles. The bipolarity of a writer who wants to escape into his art, his words, and feels guilty for having betrayed the democratic principles and obligations taught him by his parents. In Agnon's tale, a man, a writer perhaps, remembers with uneasiness that a long time has passed since he visited his father living in the distant town of his childhood. Painters have come on this the night before Passover to plaster and whitewash the man's workroom walls, and he frets that his work and his books will be ruined by their carelessness. A child appears, his young niece, as if from thin air, and he treats her with neither love nor charity. He finds himself as though transported there in the streets of his father's town and invents reasons why he ought not to pay his respects at once to his father and allows trivial interruptions by a second child, an innkeeper, an interpreter of obscure biblical texts to keep him from performing his filial duty. Resisting sleep, to which one senses he long before this surrendered, the narrator, surely he is a writer, struggles to open his eyes. Suddenly I heard a noise like that of a sheet being torn. Actually no sheet was being torn, but one small cloud high above was being torn. And once it was torn, the moon came out, splitting the clouds, and a sweet light shone upon the house and upon Father. And having lost mine not so very long ago, I say to you that, for me, now, this is my favorite story." Now, his summary of the story is a little bit off. There are some elements that he missed. So, for example, it wasn't magically transported there. He took a train. But the theme that he's highlighting here, the longing for one's parents, although earlier in the quote, he has a conflict about it, where on the one hand he embraces his art, and on the other hand there are the ideals of his parents to consider, are themes in this story. And when you read somebody who is a professional novelist and he says, "This is my favorite story right now," that sort of makes you think, well, what does he see here? What is it that appeals to him, and what is it that I should be seeing?
What does he mean by betraying the democratic principles?
That's a really good question.
I thought he was talking about himself and that he feels a kindred spirit.
Possibly. Possibly. In other words, this is what he described in his Love Among the Particles.
Walk, yes, I think so. That's what I mean.
It's possible. In other words, it could be that what he simply means is that he has been torn away from the world of his parents, which in his personal case is the democratic principles versus the art.
Or in his case,
yeah.
It's a law.
Yeah.
In case, okay, yeah, I thought he meant that alone.
Right. No, I wrestled with that one also and was not clear, and I think what you're suggesting is good. But that, you know, that really drove me to say, okay, let's see what this is, you know, what this is about. Like the rest of Sefer HaMa'asim, Book of Deeds, it is a surreal story. I'm assuming everyone has read it, or coming in knowing the story. It's a dreamlike sequence, and it's intended to be so. One writer who I found extremely helpful in approaching this was Stephen Katz. The Centrifugal novel, which I quote here in number 2 and in a couple of the other sources, is available online on Google Books, so you can read it there if you don't actually have it. But he writes in number 2 about some of the imagery. The hero's recurring difficulty with opening his eyes while making his way back home, right? If you remember, he's walking through and he's trying to keep his eyes open and he can't, is also unexplained in To Father's House, because he starts from a different standpoint. He's dealing with a different story, which we'll refer to later. Further enhancing its dreamlike character and possibilities of meaning. As expected, the more explicit version of the manuscript, because he's comparing manuscripts of To Father's House, the more explicit version of the manuscript provides a reason, which is perhaps as mystifying as having no explanation at all. Because, here's the quote, the gray sun burned my eyes. In truth, the thing happened at night, when the sun does not rain, but the deed occurred in a dream. And in a dream, there is no difficulty for the sun to shine at night. This is a quote that doesn't make it into the version that we have, although it's a very unknown quote. You know, this sort of parenthesized statement of, wasn't that odd that this was happening at night, and yet I saw a sun? But the point that Katz makes in this piece, from which I excerpted a little bit, is that it's intended to be dreamlike. It's intended to be something that is surreal. And the imagery that Agnon draws on, is often a religious imagery and should be seen in that light. If you take a look at number 3, this piece from Dr. Chaim Chamiel, who was an Israeli poet, he, in this context, in this essay of his, which appeared, I think, in a publication of the Israeli Ministry of Education, is talking about the use of literature to teach in religious schools. And here in this section, he's talking about Agnon. So he writes, I brought you the original Hebrew in my translation. I'll read out my translation. I brought you the Hebrew for the sake of completeness. But he says, anecdotes barely appear in the Book of Deeds. Right? You don't really see anecdotes. Instead, before us are segments of confession for hopes, longings, ambitions, and desires, pursuit of a goal, and disappointments. And that's certainly true. I've read probably half a dozen of the stories in Sefer HaMa'asim carefully. And in each one, you know, there's this pursuit of something, and he doesn't get there. He's trying to reach for something, but he's not achieving it.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah. The Book of Deeds is a book of confessions and dreams of a man who is immersed, he says, in a life of Torah and, it should be, reverence. My apologies. Spellcheck wouldn't pick that up. A religious man for whose spirit reality lies in wait to split and rend it. The speaker's illusions and dreams are of holidays, prayer, the study hall, and the world of the dead who appear at his side in great numbers in times of crisis. The speaker, the one who confesses, is buffeted between hope and despair and between longing and loss of will. This is the nature in general in the Book of Deeds, where he goes back and forth between wanting something and then getting involved in trivialities and losing his focus. Hoping for something and then giving up hope. And much of the imagery is this religious imagery. In fact, in truth, much of it is actually a split between, on the one hand, religious imagery and secular imagery, and him being drawn in different directions, something that I think we'll see very clearly in this story.
What's the Book of Deeds?
Sefer HaMa'asim. That's the book that this is included in, that the Levet Abba begins. I always get confused by that because he has, you know, on the one hand you have the literal books, the physical books in which it's published, but he has sub-books that are collections of his stories that appear within. So this book that I'm holding is Samukh V'Nir'eh, but Samukh V'Nir'eh includes within it Sefer HaMa'asim, among others. So it's what they usually translate in English as the Book of Deeds.
I don't think it was ever completed. I think you probably intended to have a larger volume and didn't complete it, so
interesting. I didn't know that. Okay. So, that's just in general about the genre that we're going to be looking at. Something surreal, something with religious elements in it, and a story in which he longs for something and he's not achieving it. So, to summarize the story very quickly, it has three parts. In the first part, as was already mentioned, he is sitting with his work. He is frustrated by his work. He is frustrated by the workmen who show up and take over his house to whitewash. He pretends first to be focused on a hole in the ceiling that has bugs coming through, and he's going to work on that, and then he gives that up. And he decides he's going to go home to his father, who he hasn't seen for many years, for Pesach. That's part one. Part two, I'm sure his family was overjoyed that he was announcing himself on Erev Pesach, but nonetheless... Part two, he tries to go, he takes the train, trying to go home. The train takes a long time, he says, for reasons that are not my fault. He tries to go to shul, to the synagogue. But he says, I'm not going to go to my father's shul, because I don't want to disturb his concentration and his fervor. I'm going to go to a different shul. In the courtyard of the shul, first he sees a candle in a bottle, floating in the air. And that distracts him, it disturbs him. And then, before he can go in, he's stopped by a gentleman by the name of Isaac Euchel, who we're going to come back to. And Euchel wants to display his genius and debate, interpret anew a section from Tanakh, either from the end of the book of Yehoshua, or the beginning of the book of Hosea. We're going to come back to that, because I think that matters a great deal. After that, he's... just sort of like, we don't actually know what happens next in terms of his prayers, because then we shift to part three. Except that he has a nice discussion with Euchel also about the pronunciation, about the word in Hebrew for a match. In Hebrew it is a gafur, and this is one of those cases where the English just can't cut it. You know, the English goes match and mech in the English translation. But that's not really the point. The point isn't a greenhorn pronunciation. The point is gafur and gafrir. He's mocking the Hebrew word that's been developed for it. But they have this little exchange, which I want to come back to, about the Hebrew word for a match. And then, in the third part, he tries to go to his father's house. He ends up in a tavern, right? A room with bottles and jugs and so forth on the table. And then he wants to leave, and they're annoyed that he walked in and he's leaving. So he promises, don't worry, I'm going to come back, knowing he isn't going to come back. That if he ever visits, he's going to be staying instead at his father's house. Then he tries to go to his father's house, but he can't find it. He can't get there. He's looking for someone to help him. Ultimately, he arrives, and he waits outside as he sees his father about to recite Kiddush. And then there's this great sound, and it's the tearing of a cloud as the moon becomes visible. That's your story. So, to me, this is a story of journeys. But I see at least three different journeys going on within the story. What journeys do you see in this story?
His own journey, I think, is the interesting one. Not the journey on the train, but his journey to his father, and I think it implies a journey back to the tradition with Chaya Pesach. Mm-hmm. From the life he had been leading. But there's nothing in it. I mean, the beginning is just, the painters are in the way. I'll go visit my father after 20 years. It's a very strange...
Right. Correct.
But nevertheless, that's also a journey. Mm-hmm. Making contact.
Right. What I'm actually getting at is that he takes three journeys. I don't mean three physical journeys. There is a journey in each of the three sections. Meaning, in the first section, he had the train ride. In the second section, he's journeying to the synagogue. In the third section, he's trying to journey to the house. But I mean that his journey overall, his arc of searching, can be read on three levels. One of them is the religious level, and that's actually the one I want to come to last, is this search for religion. But there are two other ways, two other layers here that he's journeying.
I see him as extremely conflicted and trying to resolve his conflict, and whichever step he takes, it leads him astray. It doesn't lead him to where he wants to go.
Right, and he's definitely conflicted, and I think that's part of the business of his eyes being closed, as much as Locke reads it as, you know, falling asleep, that sort of thing. But he's, no, I think that there's a real conflict within him, which we're going to see on multiple levels. I think you're right. There's a journey here.
Country to country as well. With all the passport, you know.
Did he have a passport section?
Is it not in this story where he doesn't have...
No, he has another story about...
Oh, that's another... Yeah. And it's another one in Sefer Masim.
In Sefer Masim, there is another one in passports and waiting 3 days in the office and so forth. But that's not this one.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
But the fact that the eyes were closed and he would get them open, he's hit a crack. Was that because he was resisting what he was seeing?
I think so.
Resisting the involvement or the connection?
Resisting the journey.
And, well, the journey ultimately.
The best way to make sure you don't get to your destination is if you keep your eyes closed.
Is the eyes closed a biblical reference?
Interesting. The one who comes to mind is Bilam with the closed eye or the open eye, but but I'm not sure what I would do with that here. It's a good question.
But would he have gone on that journey if the builders had not come in?
Very good.
Then there's the hole in the wall with the branches, and that must have some kind of meaning.
Good.
You know, that the branches, and there was the hole, and why was that hole there?
Right. So we're going to come to that also. The hole I'm not going to spend as much time on as the whitewashers, but in general, I think that's an important point. The three layers of journey that I see in this story, the first one is that he misses his father, the personal layer. I haven't talked to my father in so long. I want to go see him. You'll see what I'm seeing. You'll see what I'm getting at. The second layer is Europe. This story is published in 1941. It's actually written first in the 30s, but it's published in 1941 at a time when he is going to be aware of the destruction in Europe already. And it's about the inability to journey back home to Eastern Europe. And then the third will be the religious layer. Let's take them one by one. The first layer, missing his father. So keep in mind, we know a little bit about Agnon's father, and as various writers note, when you get to the stories in Sefer HaMaasim, it's very difficult to tell where Agnon ends and the protagonist begins. He inserts all sorts of detail about his protagonists, which are clearly about himself. So he'll have one be called up to the Torah as a Levi, and he noted frequently that he was. The protagonist is generally a writer, as he is. So keeping that in mind, and looking at his father, Agnon's father was an ordained rabbi. Shalom Mordechai Halevi, Chashkas was his name. He didn't work in the rabbinate. He wasn't a professional rabbi. He worked in the fur business. But he was a chassid also, which is going to matter a little bit later. He's from the Chortkover Chassidim. So the father, I believe, has passed on. His father is gone by the time this story shows up. And as Locke said, this is a man searching for his father, but he can't reach him. His father is gone. And so in the dream sequence, his journey is obstructed, it is unfulfilled, and it's frankly unfulfillable. So reading the story in this light, we start out with him at home, at work, and he is uncomfortable at home. He's annoyed with his work. Something is bothering him. The workmen show up, and what the workmen do is they enhance for him a sense of dislocation. They act as though the place is theirs. The workman slouches on the ladder, putting himself through the rungs of the ladder. They're not going to care what they make dirty, and he's going to tell them you should cover the books, and they're not going to listen to him. He feels dislocated. I don't belong here. Now, when you are in a situation like that, you have two choices. Choice number one is tough it out, and choice number two is go away. He makes a play of toughing it out. Right? He's looking at this hole, I have this type to take care of with the house, and this is going to be a project, and I'm going to clear away the branches, and I'll get a board, and I'll cover it up. But his heart isn't in it. Right? His young relative shows up to try to help him, and he shoos her away. He's not really interested in toughing it out. he doesn't feel like he belongs. And to me, that's the role of the workman at this stage, is to show this feeling of lack of ownership and I don't belong. So he goes to this, to his father's town. He wants to see his father, but he's afraid of disturbing his father. He doesn't want to create disturbance by going in. That would create distance if he would. And so he sees a candle in a bottle. Now this is my great find in this story. I'm very proud of this. You couldn't have done this before Google. I searched high and low for someone who could explain candle in a bottle as an image. And everyone just said it's some surreal image and they didn't really have anything to offer. However, if you Google the phrase for it in Hebrew, this phrase is used in the writings of Breslov or Hasidim. In a story about Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And it is as surreal as any Agnon story you will ever read. This bizarre story. And as part of the story, there is a candle in a bottle up in the heavens, and then there are people who gather around, and they have a basket of merits, and they throw the merits up at the glass bottle, and glass comes raining down on them, and it's a very strange passage. But I brought you, on your sheet, in source number 4, the explanation of the story from Chaye Moharan, the life of Rabbi Nachman. And that's why I emphasize his father being Hasidish. I think Agnon is very familiar with this story.
What number?
Number 4. He says, the lamp from which sparks fell into their mouths, and then the lamp became a river, etc., which is in the story, represents warm words emerging from the celestial heart, meaning the heart above, as divine mercy is aroused for him, and the celestial heart opens, and from that celestial heart flow words, and through this the explanations of Torah flow, as in Tehillim, the rock opened and water flowed. And this is the conversion of a lamp to a river, for the lamp represents the heart, which is known to be a burning lamp. If that didn't make sense to you, you ain't seen nothing. That's not the story. That's the explanation of the story. But the point that I wanted to draw from it was that in that story, as the Breslovers themselves explained it, the image of a lamp in a bottle floating in the air is the image of the heart, that which one desires. That's the image of the lamp in the bottle. And so Agnon describes himself arriving at the shul, at the synagogue, and he sees the lamp in a bottle signifying this is where you want to be. This is your goal. And then he encounters Isaac Eichel, who at this layer, I'm just going to read as a nuisance, but we're going to have to come back to him. Reading it in terms of his desire to get to his father, Eichel is just somebody who's in the way. And then he tries to get to his father's house in part 3, and he can't find the place, he can't get to his father. He ends up in a tavern, and in the tavern, he again sees the lamp in the bottle. Now, it's very interesting, because if you think about the wording, when he sees the lamp in the bottle at the tavern, he says, V'ner hayatalui sham v'avir betoch bagbuk. There was a lamp suspended in the air within a bottle, like I saw in the yard of the synagogue. But it might have been two candles that just looked like they were one candle, he says. And he's not really sure, because on the one hand, he sees that this is also where he wants to be. He also wants to be in the tavern. But he's confused by that, because he wanted to be in the synagogue. So that's going to play into the other layers. But he sees it again in part 3. He makes a promise he's going to go back. He's going to go back, and then he leaves to go to his father's house. He gets to the house. He wants to get his father's attention, but he's ambivalent. He can't do it until ultimately light shines through, and we don't get the ending. Maybe that means his father will now see him, or not. Agnon leaves that vague. He doesn't have an ending. So that's one layer to the story. A man trying to go home to his dad, to his father. His father's already deceased. He's not getting to him in life. But it's this image of him trying to get to him and the ambivalence that he feels along the way.
Is Isaac Eichel's name, does that have any significance
yes.
to anything.
You bet. We're getting to that we're going to get to that in the third layer. So hang in there, because we're getting to that.
I want to ask you about the candles.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a function at the simplest level of giving light.
Yes.
And the idea was that they were illuminating something that would therefore tempting. And the first one was in the courtyard.
Yeah.
And the second was in the
Tavern.
In the tavern, and there were two candles. Like, I thought that this was really the question of the Hasidic business. I didn't understand.
Yeah.
But that sort of strengthens it.
Yeah, it does.
That kind of strengthens it. That this was something that he was looking to.
Right.
You know, and being drawn to, as light does.
Right. Right. No, it's true. And yes, or is a royal tzaddik, but or generally representing light and purity. All true. And then the confusion of that showing up in the tavern. You know, is that, what kind of message is that supposed to send?
The light coming through glass is diffused. It doesn't come through clear.
Right. So what would you do with that? Just in general, so it's a part of
relation.
Right. Could be. So the second layer, the pre-war Europe layer, I mentioned that according to Lahore, whose work I quoted you in number 5, Dan Lahore, this is published in the summer of 1941, and it uses imagery that Agnon also used in his novel in 1939, A Guest for the Night. So Lahore writes the following about this. Source number 5, the bottom of the first slide, leading on to the next slide. But from September 1939 onward, Agnon knew full well that the German occupation of most of Polish territory, together with the Soviet occupation of East Galicia, the country of his birth, heralded the end of the Jewish community in Poland. Furthermore, the story appeared in the June-July issue of Gazette magazine. This coincided with the invasion of the Soviet Union by a million-strong German army, and the German occupation of all of Polish territory, sealing the fate of Polish Jewry, including the Jews of Galicia. Thus, the journey described in To Father's House can easily be construed as Agnon's metaphorical attempt to return to the landscape of his childhood, even though he was well aware that the return was truly belated. Impossible, in fact, owing to the new political situation that had emerged in Europe between September 1939 and June 1941. In general, it's a very interesting article and worth reading. It's available online. This did Agnon write about the Holocaust. So you read the story this way, and once again, you have the sense of dislocation at home when it's emphasized when the workmen come in. He wants to see his home. He goes back to the synagogue. He's afraid of disturbing. He encounters that world. And now you see Euchel criticizing that world. With his comments about the word for match, he's criticizing that world that Agnon is looking for. And then he tries to go home, and he's distracted in the tavern, and so on. But the third layer is the richest layer of all in this story to me, and that's the journey to religion. Remember that Agnon grows up with a strong religious identity in his youth. He leaves it for a time. He comes to Israel and finds himself in a new religious society, and he goes looking for the religion of his youth, ultimately. And this story can be understood as his search for, so to speak, Abba with a capital Aleph. Right? He's searching for his father. He's searching for God. And here, this is something that's picked up on by a few writers. I thank Professor Vassar, who sent me one article which I saw on this. There are a few who write about it, but this was from Ephraim Orbach in Prakim Shal Sefer HaMedina, Mekumangas Samuch V'Nir'eh. Stephen Katz does it also in this satirical novel, which I brought you in source number 6. So I don't know. I have to read his whole book, or at least his preface, probably, in order to know. I don't know. I only read the parts that connected to Sefer HaMaasim for this. He writes in source number 6, placed within the novel, when he says the novel, he means A Guest for the Night, placed within the novel's context, The father's house is an expression of the hero's attempted escape from the reality he comes to know in Shibush, which is a place and a guest for the night, an escape motivated by his observation that all remnants of the world of the past, of the sanctity of the traditions to which he is drawn, have vanished. The hero's sole path in finding spiritual comfort remains a leap of the imagination to a shibush of the past, a hindsight accompanied by an atavistic cry of the child within the man for his parent. Thus, the frenzied search for comfort in father's house. Now, this blends the issue of Holocaust and searching for the spiritual identity of his youth and for God. Dr. Mordechai Wurzel said it stronger in source number 7. In a commentary on Sefer HaMaasim, he writes, "This rejection of faith, with a sense of separation from roots, and the difficulty of returning to them, to those roots, and the fear of revenge from God, the great Father in heaven, as described in To Father's House," meaning not the punishment, but the desire to return, but the fear of returning inappropriately, like don't go into the synagogue, could inspire that strange world, unstable and chaotic, found in the stories of the Book of Deeds. Reading this way, I come to the following way to look at this. Stage 1, once again, he's uncomfortable at home. I don't really belong. The whitewashers come in. If it's his house, who sent the whitewashers? Right? There's something here. There's this sense of dislocation that he has, and it stirs his desire to return to religion, to go back to the way he grew up. He wants to go back to the religion of his youth. And the candle envisioned in the bottle is a sign that this is the place his heart desires. He's going back to the synagogue. But he's afraid he won't fit in. And then he encounters Isaac Euchel. So who is Isaac Euchel? So here I have the help of a few different articles. Isaac Euchel was a well-known European maskil, a member of the Haskalah of the Enlightenment. And what Agnon's protagonist is doing here is he is rejecting Euchel's satire and Euchel's writing. Euchel in general was a satirist against tradition. I brought you source number 8 from the Yuvo Encyclopedia of Jews in Eastern Europe from their entry on satire in source number 8. He says, "The origins of modern Jewish satire may be traced to late 18th century Germany. Its prominent and most militant creators included Yitzchak Euchel, Shaul Levin Berlin, and Aharon Halley Wolfson. They aimed their venom at superficial intellectuals whose enlightenment was mere lip service on the one hand, and the hypocrisy of Orthodox religious fanatics on the other." So, equal opportunity offender, but very, very sharp. Well, Euchel was targeted by many, not just by Agnon, as a figure to be mocked. Agnon wrote a very short story about him. If you take a look at source number 9, this is a story in its entirety about Isaac Euchel. I found it in a footnote in Stephen Katz's book, but I also found someone else who translated it. I was going to bring the Hebrew too, but I wanted to keep my sheet to one page, so I apologize. But you can find it online. This is the story. Rabbi Aaron Freeman, may his memory be blessed, telling from Rabbi Eliyahu Flesner, may his memory be blessed, told me, Itzik Euchel and his friends found a Gentile woman who cooked for them on Tisha B'Av. Right? Tisha B'Av, national fast day, Jews aren't going to cook food for you. So they had a non-Jewish woman, hence the title of the story in Hebrew, Hagoyah Shel Tisha B'Av.
It's a by Agnon?
By Agnon. It's a play on Hagoy Shel Shabbat, the idea of the non-Jew who does things for you on Shabbos. So this is Hagoy Shel Tisha B'Av. She's going to be the Tisha B'Av cook.
He doesn't say what volume it's in.
It's in Tachrich. What's it called? Tachrich, yes.
I've never been able to find that book.
Right, well, that's where it's supposed to be found. Tachrich Sipurim. They called her the Gentile woman of Tisha B'Av. One Tisha B'Av Eve, they came and told Itzik Euchel that the Gentile woman of Tisha B'Av had died. He said to his friends, "Friends, let me tell you something. It is not possible that between today and tomorrow we can find another Gentile woman to cook for us for Tisha B'Av. Therefore, since the Gentile woman of Tisha B'Av had died, let us fast together on this Tisha B'Av with all of Israel over the destruction of Jerusalem." That's the story. It's what it amounts to and what Oikla represents. He's not going to fast for the destruction of the temple. He's going to fast because the woman who cooked for him passed away, and now he has nobody to replace her. Had he somebody to replace her, he wouldn't fast.
Convenient.
Yes. So the way that I read this insertion of Oikla here is he is searching. Right, the protagonist in the story is searching for a way back to religion. Oichel represents the fellow who is cynical about religion, and it's blocking him from getting home. And he wants to tell him his story about that passage in Hosea or Yoshua, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. But he's going to tell you his interpretation. Now, the article that you provided me from Urbach, he says, you have to read carefully about his response to Oichel. Because, looking in the text of the story itself, when Oichel is presenting him with his story, he says, "Aval pichein nianati lo roshi." Even though I felt that the explanations given by others much earlier had been simple and clear and straightforward, Oichel wasn't necessary, nonetheless I nodded my head. As though we needed his explanation. So the truth is, my read of that is to say, he's saying, yeah, we need you like a hole in the head, let me go on. But Orbach says, no, what he's saying is, there is something there within the Haskalah, there's something there within the Enlightenment that is worthy. Could be. I'm certainly not about to pick up my word.
One other thing.
Yeah.
That there's Yehoshua and Hosea.
That's where I'm going now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Can I say one?
Yeah, please.
There was a question about centrifugal book.
Yes.
It makes me think that the centrifugal force,
yes,
is Abraham Amerkaz. That's basically what the law of physics is. So maybe here the meaning is the Merkaz is Yadud, the belief, and he's pushed. Eh? That's what the force, physical force, to our side.
Fascinating idea. I should have read the introduction to his book and then I'd really have a definitive answer. But it's a nice explanation. The question really fundamentally is, as you point out, centrifugal force in physics is what will keep you going in your arc and not be pulled into the center. Right? That's the, you know, that would be the idea. But it's still something of momentum that is drawing you to go forward. I don't know. I don't know what to do with the title. It's worth looking into.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Which draws you in? Centrifuge or centrifuge?
Centrifugal force
is
what...
Pushes you out? Yes. Pushes you out and centrifuge brings you in.
The centripetal force, right. The centrifugal and centrifugal. If you really want to know, I can Google it on my phone and we can get the explanation.
Fuga in Latin is freca.
Yeah. No, I'm saying that's true. The meaning of centrifugal is not really the debate. But if you want, I can look up the preface to his book on my phone. Then we can know what he was actually talking about. But yes, it means to run away. It means to flee from the center. That's the idea. In terms of what Oichel picks on, the end of Hosea, the start of Yoshua. So Urbach notes that Hosea is actually the name of Yehoshua until he has a yud added to his name, which the sages on, right, before the mission of the spies, when they're going to go to the land of Canaan, so Moshe takes Hosea and he renames him Yehoshua, and the message that the Talmud reads there is, God, represented by the yud added to his name, God will save you from the counsel of the spies. Hosea itself, as a root, is a term for rescue salvation. God will rescue you. So the way Urbach reads it is that Yehoshua represents those who seek salvation with God, whereas Hosea is those who seek salvation without God. That's the way that Urbach reads it, playing into this split between the desire to come back to tradition and the desire to flee from it. And so that's one possible read. But I think there's something else going on. I benefit from having taught Sefer Yoshua recently, and it's fresh enough in my head that I think there's another layer going on. Take a look at source number 10 and 11. Source number 10 is from the last chapter in Yoshua. Yoshua, at the end of his life, offers two speeches to the nation as a whole. One is in chapter 23 of the book, and one is in chapter 24. In chapter 24, when he addresses the people, he says to them, are you going to follow God or not? As a matter of fact, I think it's either Malbim or Radak who says that's why he needs chapter 24. Because in chapter 23, he gives his speech to the nation. And then in 24, it's the same address, basically. The same content of stick to God. But what he does in 24 that he didn't do in chapter 23 is that he asks them questions and expects them to respond. He felt like 23 didn't take. His first speech didn't take. He needs to come back to them and do better pedagogically. And so he's going to call upon them to affirm their faith. And he says to them, are you going to follow God? Or are you going to just stray? And he actually is even stronger. He says, you can't possibly follow God. And they say, yes, we can. Reverse psychology. But take a look at number 10. And the nation replied and said, it will be a disgrace for us to leave God to serve the gods of others. For Hashem, our God, is the one who brought us and our ancestors up from Egypt to the house of slaves, and so on. That's what you see in the last chapter of Yehoshua. It's dedication to God, dedication to covenant. Now look at the beginning of Hosea, the famous beginning of the book of Hosea. Right? Hosea is the prophet whom God addresses and says to him, the Jews have strayed from me like a spouse straying from the other spouse. And look at what he says here. This is the opening statement that God gives to Hosea, after which surely he went to the doctor to see if he was hearing things. Go take for yourself a woman of straying and children of straying, for the land strays from after God. He tells him to marry a harlot, is the story. And have children with her, which he isn't going to know whether they're his own or not. And the image is of the Jewish people who have strayed from God in that way. Because how dare you tell me that I should stay with them? Would you stay with this woman who has been unfaithful to you? That's the image in the beginning of Hosea. So that what you have then, as Oichol is challenging him, is there were two sections of which Oichol may have been commenting. He says, I don't remember which one it was, right? I don't remember which one Oichol was talking about. He might have been talking about the end of Yehoshua, which is all about faith and commitment. Or he might have been talking about the beginning of Hosea, which is all about straying from God and wandering somewhere else. When I first was reading this story, I felt bad because the story that we did the last time I spoke for the group, we did Baderech. And there was so much imagery pulled from Tanakh and from Talmud to draw on. And in this story, there really isn't that much to work with. But here, I found it. It's here. This is, again, that split that he has between the world of the Enlightenment and the tavern and so forth. And on the other hand, the world of religion that he is seeking to return to, and that's the covenant and the synagogue. So he then ultimately decides he wants to go to his father's house, and he's distracted in the tavern, which is also the place of his ambition, and then you get the rest of the story. So three layers, three different journeys. The journey to a father who is gone, the journey to the land of Eastern Europe, and the journey to religion, all beginning from a point of dislocation, all involving a degree of ambivalence and self-doubt, and ultimately we don't know if he succeeds in any of them because of this vague ending with the cloud rending and the stars, the moon shining through, which, by the way, other stories also end with in Sefer HaMaasim. One of the other story that I had taught I taught at Shari Shemayim, HaTizmoret. Also a similar ending there.
It's also Erebachat.
And it's Arashana, right, which is what I used it for. But yes, it's another Erebachat.
And there's all these delays and whatever.
Right, Erebachat Yom Tov is a good time for delays and journeys and such. So, one more piece, though. Because Pesach, this story is supposed to be about Pesach. Was it just random that he picked this Yom Tov? It could have been Erev Sukkis, it could have been Erev whatever. I don't think so. I think it's very important that this is about Pesach. And for a reason that I never thought about it, but certainly didn't give it as much attention as I'm going to now. What's the obvious association, obvious, so obvious I missed it, but what's the obvious association between this story and Pesach?
To me, Pesach, for every other big fancy things, is a festival of change.
Meaning?
And we change. I mean, you know, after the Chayrut and to nationhood and so on. But he went through a change at Pesach.
So there's a change.
Brings us back to our roots.
Okay, bring meaning.
That we all gather and remember what it is that we have in common and why we're here.
Okay.
It's also to our father, that he gathered to you in
hearts. Oh, that's good. There's the intergenerational.
The intergenerational.
What else? All true, but there's something else. Yeah.
Pesach is a journey.
Pesach is a journey.
Wow.
And what to me was striking about this that I hadn't thought about, what's the term that we use in Hebrew to talk about the Exodus? What's our Hebrew term? Yitziat Mitzrayim. Yitziat Mitzrayim is the emphasis on leaving Egypt, and so that's the way I've always thought about it. But it's not the only way to think about the Exodus. What else is it? We're going somewhere.
Redemption.
It's redemption, but we're going to our ancestral land. Right? From the very first time God speaks to Moses, he says, I remember the covenant, this land that I promised to give, that I'm going to bring you to, you minus Moses and the entire generation, but hey, but that's the Exodus is not only getting out of Egypt, it's going levate Abba. It's going to the house of our ancestors. I had never thought about it that way. But I think that's why this is Erev Pesach. It's our journey home, and it is a journey filled with ambivalence. Who is more ambivalent than the generation of Jews who are in the wilderness? For goodness sake, one day you're getting the Torah, and the next day you're building a calf. Right? You send your spies.
We're saying we should go back to Egypt.
We want to go back to Egypt.
More ambivalent than saying, let's get back where we were.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
The ambivalence is throughout. They're ambivalent about Moses, there are rebellions against him in the wilderness, there are mutinies, they're ambivalent about the gifts God is giving them, the man, which on the one hand they're happy for, and they go out to collect when they're not supposed to, and on the other hand they complain that they don't like it. The ambivalence, you know, throughout the spies, right? You send the spies to the land and you complain we don't want it, right? I mean, that's exactly the image. We're looking at Beit Abba, but, you know, maybe we'll go somewhere else instead. There's this striking ambivalence throughout the journey, and I think it fits actually very well with the imagery of the story. If you go back to the beginning of the story, and his description of his work. And this was really, when I saw this, that's when I broke the curve of confusion. Then I said, okay, now I think I know what's going on. He describes his work. Ve'asiti et avodati, I did my work. Zo ha'avoda she'ein la tchila ve'ein la sof. This is the work that has no beginning and no end. She'nichnasin ba'shalo betova ve'ein yotzim mimena olamit. You go into it without any benefit, and you never get done with it. Is that not slavery? And especially when you consider the Talmudic imagery of slavery, I should have brought it on the sheet and found a way to somehow sneak it in. But the Talmudic understanding, when they build the cities of Pitom and Ramses, is that those are what kind of cities?
Store.
They're storehouses. That's a Torah description, a miskinot, right? But it describes them as cities that are built on swamps, where you build and it sinks into the ground, and you build and it sinks into the ground. You're never accomplishing anything. You're just working for the sake of working. So that's his description of the work that he is in. He is starting out in Egypt. And I didn't know whether I'd be going too far by saying that the fly is coming in the hole, or like the Urov, or, you know, something along those lines. I thought that might be a little bit more than he intended. But the whitewashers demonstrate that they own the place. It's not really yours. And that galut, sorry.
Would the palms be the mortar, part of the mortar?
Oh, that would be interesting. The branches could be from the mortar? Could be. I always struggle at this stage with how much am I inventing and how much is really there. So I don't know really where the line is.
You know, when you said before that you had not made, you'd forgotten the connection between leaving and where to. But we do that. I mean, look at them, when he says, everyone says, Shalach et ami.
Yeah.
But it's the next part that matters, the
duty.
Part.
Right.
And that's the part that we sort of
right. It's true. You're 100% right. And not only that, when you think about it, he goes through the same thing in the story. Yeah. Because he doesn't get where he's going, but he left Egypt. he just didn't get anywhere. But you're right.
It's throughout the story.
It is left open at the end. It is left open.
It's not a total negative.
But would he wanted to have gone to his father if his place was not in such a mess as it was?
No. Well, that's the thing. The imagery that he's giving us is, this has been in a mess forever. The place has been a wreck forever. It's only now that he is deciding, I've had enough. And I think that's the idea, that he awakens and says, time to go. That's to my mind the way it works.
The plasterers
are our Moshe, yes.
And when people make Aliyah, they know when it's the time to go.
There you go. Well, or they find out. But the second part was what sealed the deal for me. Yehoshua and Hosea, take a look, please, at your sheet, the last source I brought you. This should ring a bell. If it doesn't ring a bell now, will it a couple of weeks? Vayomer Yehoshua Kalam. I would do it in a sing-song like they do at my family Seder. Maybe that would help. And Yehoshua said to the entire nation, so declares Hashem, God of Israel, by the river your ancestors dwell forever, Terah, father of Abraham and father of Nahor, and they serve the gods of others, and so forth. This is in our Haggadah. The section that Isaac Eichel is talking to him about is the end of Yehoshua. This is that same last chapter of Yehoshua. Isaac Eichel is interpreting for him on the night of Pesach a passage which is either from the Haggadah or from this beginning of Hosea about leaving God altogether. So that I think the Pesach theme is really very strong and made stronger by the terminology he uses in the third part when he describes the inn. This inn drove me nuts. First of all, realizing that it was a tavern, because the translation I looked at on it said inn, and that biased me. I was going back and forth between the Hebrew and the English, because the Hebrew uses the Aramaic term achsanya. Achsanya is usually an inn. It is, like a place where you stay, but it's not only that. It also can be a pub or a tavern. And that clicked when I realized the phrase was a table with bottles and jars and cups. That's a place where people drink, right? That's what it is. But well, look at the table itself. It is Shulchan Aruch, as in Shulchan Orech, as in your Seder table, is what he envisions, but it's a Seder table filled with bottles. Now, maybe it's the four cups of wine, but I don't think so. I think it's meant to be in a bar. It's an ersatz Shulchan Orech, conveying his split religious personality. He doesn't get to his father's home. The generation in the Midbar does not get to go into Israel. And then I wondered, and here I may be reaching, whether the cloud tearing and the light shining through is the giving of the Torah at Sinai. I wasn't sure if I was going too far with that one. Remains to be seen. You can, certainly the imagery of the cloud in general, clouds of glory escort them and protect them through the wilderness.
But the Anan,
sorry?
It's the Anan that the people followed in the
right.
That's in the daytime. At night it's a fire.
Well, the fire in the bottle, maybe. Who knows? The fire in the bottle at the Amudesh. Sorry?
It could also be a yahrzeit candle, a fire in the bottle.
Right. If you go back to the imagery of him looking for his father and his father being passed on, you can certainly read it that way. I think that's certainly possible. So what we see here is a story that, on the one hand, can be read as these three journeys. He misses his father, he misses his homeland, he misses his religion. But I think it is a Pesach story about a journey of somebody who is getting out of his own Egypt and wants to return to God. He wants to leave behind his exile from religion and his slavery in order to return to God, but he's very torn. And you see it in the imagery of the candle. But if you wanted the candle to be the Amud Esh, this pillar of flame that is leading him, it's leading him in different directions. He's, on the one hand, hearing this verse, which may be from the Haggadah, but it may also be from Hosea about distance. And ultimately, he doesn't get to his father's home. So I think this is effectively sort of a child who doesn't know whether he is the Russia or not. He doesn't know which of the four kids at the Seder he is. And he's trying to figure himself out in terms of who he's going to be. So that was another layer that I saw in the story. Again, I am very glad to have had the opportunity. I would never have forced myself into, you know, going through the story if not for the invitation. So thank you very much.
Thank you.